And I think we need to think hard. I think that I find current times both very challenging, but also very exciting, because we need to rethink a lot of the blocks. We are still basically debating 19th century theories.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Haltime. My name is Matilda Fasting, and today I'm joined by Luigi Zingales. This is a podcast in our MPS series, where you will meet many lecturers who visited the MPS seminar in Oslo in October 2022. Luigi is a professor of entrepreneurship and finance at the Booth School of Business. He is the 10th most cited author in the social sciences. His research on capitalism is summarized in two widely acclaimed books: Saving Capitalism from Capitalists from 2003 and A Capitalism for the People from 2012. Zingales, he also co-hosts the podcast Capitalism, but this time Luigi is a guest and we will discuss capitalism and the taming of corporate power, the theme for his conference talk. First of all, welcome Luigi.
My pleasure.
We'll have to start with your podcast. I know that you are familiar with that because you have your own. Why have you called it Capitalism?
So I think that it's a clever name that was invented by my previous co-host, Kate Waldock. And I think captures very well the tension of debating what is right and what is wrong with capitalism. So is I think the idea is what is working in capitalism today and what isn't. So that's what Capital Isn't is about.
And your school, you and the Booth School, is from Chicago. So normally it's in, that's where it is. And normally people will think about a very pro-capitalist university in Chicago if we're thinking a few decades back.
Actually, there is a very interesting question of what is the Chicago School.
Yes.
It's something that we are planning a conference next year to try to analyze what has been over the years and what is now, because as everything in life, it evolves. And the old Chicago School that is represented by Frank Knight, Jacob Viner, and Harry Simons is very different from the more popular, if you want, and more recent Chicago School of Friedman, Stigler, and Becker, and is also different from what people think today. So I think that there is a evolution. I think there are also some constant, but that's what the conference is going to try to find out.
And probably that's going to be talked about in your podcast as well.
Yes.
Yeah, I believe so. But this summer you had been talking about neoliberalism and you have had different guests, including Francis Fukuyama, and he is out with his new book, Liberalism and its Discontents. And you talked about your concerns about neoliberalism. What are they and what are your main criticism when it comes to, you can first maybe also define what you mean by neoliberalism.
Wow, that's
a question.
Huge question. I'm not so sure that I have the right preparation to define neoliberalism. And I find it a little bit also disturbing, because neoliberalism is often used as a negative term. And so I'm not so sure that I'm prepared to give a proper definition of neoliberalism. What I can tell you is that I'm concerned about our ability in general, not just of liberal, but our ability to do two things. Number one, respond to the failure of the market economy to deliver growth to the bottom half of the income distribution. For an extended period of time. I think that that is problematic, because one of the winning points of liberalism in general is that we can produce a better world for everybody, not just for a small few, but for everybody. So I think that that's problem number one. Problem number two, that is more on the political side. So this is on the economic side. On the political side, there is a fundamental contradiction between a strong belief in democracy in advanced places and a distrust of more, if you want, democratic institution at the international level. So in the old days in the Soviet Union, there was a debate about communism in one country versus communism in the world, etc. I think we're facing that in the world ourselves, in the liberal world ourselves. Do you believe in liberalism in one country or do you believe liberalism in the world? And if liberalism in the world, who decides the rules of that? And traditionally, the rules have been imposed by one country and through the use of either explicit or implicit force. And I think the world is changing, and I think we need to confront that.
So actually what you're talking about is that you might be agree to liberalism in your own country, like in Norway or in the United States or in the UK, for instance, but you are questioning if you'd like to have a liberalism, which means trade and which means globalism in a sense, also internationally. And that's when crises are coming, like we have had the pandemic, for instance, the experience is that quite quickly it comes to taking care of your own citizens, and suddenly the international level is less important until you start cooperating like the European Union did after a while.
Yeah, but even the European project is not really democratic by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah, there is a European Parliament, but is pretty useless, and everything is decided at the government level, where basically, Luxembourg, a place that has more banks than people, is as important as Germany or France or Italy. So I think that there is a fundamental asymmetry. And I think we need to confront that, because most of our problems today, from the pandemic to global warming, even international trade, are international problems. And so how do we think about some form of international order where we have very asymmetric power, of course, military power, and very asymmetric institutions. And most places are not liberal, democratic like Western Europe. And so what we're going to do, just impose our will through guns or one of the fundamental issues that emerged with the discussion with Francis Fukuyama is that liberalism needs the nation, the notion of a nation, sorry for the, but the notion of a nation, but does not have a notion of a nation. So we confronted that, for example, with Catalonia. Mm. If the people of Catalonia wanted to become a separate country, why they were not allowed to? Now, we might discuss that maybe it was not a majority, etc., but it was never on the table to say, you know, we have a referendum and maybe we need a super majority. I'm open to that. But imagine that 60% of the people in Catalonia wants to become independent. Can they or not? Mm-hmm. Because after all, if 51% of the Scottish want to become independent, they are going to become independent. So, but in Europe, you cannot become independent. I think that that's an issue, and of course there are historical tradition in nations, but there is also an economic interest, and so there is an interest of richer part of the world to close themselves up in very happy nations. Because that blocks the redistribution effect. So I think that there is a tension there.
And Italy is still one country.
yes, even if a lot of people would like to be two. I think that it's one country, but is actually, I think, profoundly divided by races within Italian people, let alone there is also races for immigrants. But I think that after spending, I'm sorry to say, more than 30 years in the United States, I became very sensitive to the issue of races. And I can say with clarity that Northern Italians, but I say the majority of Italians are really racist vis-a-vis Southern people in a way that is irritating. And to be honest, that's also true within Europe. With all due respect, but the Northern Europeans look at the Southern European with condescendence. And the thing that to me is pretty shocking is the former finance minister of the Netherlands, I think Dijsselbloem, said, we believe in solidarity, but not with people, and the reference was Southern Europe, who spend all their money in alcohol and women. Which, first of all, I don't think we have the monopoly of people drinking. I think that there are plenty. But second, I think that not even Donald Trump used those terms for its own people. Used for other people, but if you believe in Europe, you cannot treat other European with that condescendence. And the shocking thing is, was not even forced to resign, was perfectly fine. Was like a day like another one.
Well, yeah, I understand your point. And I think that is, of course, the trouble of the European Union. But let's go back to liberal democracies. And I know that you think that liberal democracies cannot work without capitalism. Can you explain?
So I think that a fundamental role in a liberal democracy is how information is created and distributed. And if you don't have a market system that allows the generation of this information and the distribution of information in a way that is not centralized or controlled by a centralized source, then I don't think you can have a true liberal democracy. And in the old days, I would say you need the free press. Now, it's not even clear what the press is anymore, but what I do believe is we do need the free generation and circulation of information. That is what liberalism is about. I don't know how to define it well, but I do know that the fundamental nature of it is the fact that different ideas can be created and circulate freely. And I think that in order for this to be possible, you have to have multiple printing press in the modern sense. Since in the old days, we were printing press. Today, there are a lot of media, etc. But if you have a centralized printing press, you don't have liberalism.
Mm. And the other way around, how do you see capitalism evolve in an authoritarian regime like China? Because that is also, it used to be capitalism comes and then liberal democracy will come, but it hasn't happened in China. And how can you describe that market system? Or is it even a market system?
So it's a very interesting question, because there's no doubt that China did remarkably well in the last 40 years. And so there is a lot to learn there. But one aspect which should not be forgotten is that the last 40 years for China has been a gigantic catch-up phase. And in the catch-up phase, the role of the free market is less important, because you know where to go. And when you are the frontier, figuring out where to go from the frontier is much more difficult. So I always use an example with graduate education. In the first 2 years in graduate school, you are taught a bunch of stuff. And there are some students who are phenomenally good at memorizing what they are told and being very effective. And then you said, you know, guys, now you're on your own, because now you are on the frontier and you have to start walking your own walk. And nobody can really guide you there, because I can give you advice, but my advice may be different from my colleague advice, and none of the two might be right. And it's just, for the past, I can tell you exactly what is right. But here now we are in the phase in which we look for the path to go. And I think that this is where, in my view, the Chinese model will enter into a crisis, because unless sort of they have a very military-driven growth, then they know where to go. I think that you do need prices to guide what people want, and this is not what China is about at all. Mm. The second point, which I think is very important, is the risk of capitalism is that the rules become for sales as well. And says, my notion of catalyst is something where everything is for sale except the rules themselves, which is, of course, a tension, because when everything is for sale, then you tend to be willing to buy the rules as well. And I think that when the rules become part of what is sold, I think that's where the corruption and the deterioration of capitalism start. And I think that democracy is... as Churchill said, the lesser evil is not a perfect system, but is a system that tries to take away the power to write the rules from the hands of the people who have the more vested interest in those rules.
And so far, as you said, China has been in a catch-up phase. But as we know, capitalism and liberal democracies, they are also driven by innovation. It's driven by failures and successes, and then it keeps on going. And it's also, as you said, important. Information is really important in that process, because if you don't get information about what works, then you can't change it or continue doing it. So, and could that be a problem for China? China has been in many ways good, but as you said, the capitalism there is probably based a little bit differently than in liberal democracies.
Yeah, I think that to some extent, China succeeded by deviating from what is the Washington consensus and what is the, if you want, the reductive form of the liberal consensus, because it has a very strong state capacity. To what extent the state capacity is the result of millennia of centralized power, because in China we're talking millennia, we're not talking centuries, let alone decades. To what extent this is a lucky outcome, I don't know, but... one important feature that we should not forget is that all the successful latecomer in capitalism are all places where the government is pretty strong and able to do a lot of stuff. And so the idea that you can succeed, especially in a catch-up phase, with a minimalist government, I think is wrong. Mm. So that's a big lesson we have to take from China. But as I said earlier, it's easier to catch up. And the question is what you do moving forward. And the risk of centralization in that remains very strong. And so my future outlook for China is not as great as the past. That's a easy prediction to make, because the past was so exceptional. But I think that it will face a number of problems, including a natality problem, mm-hmm. because the other big issue is how do you get the system to reproduce itself, and I think including reproduce children. And I think that in the past there were restrictions to have one child policy. And now you are trying to promote more than one child, which suggests that even government planning in that front doesn't work very well. Not even in demography. Demography is the easiest one to plan, because it takes at least 20 years for the next generation to come about. So you have 20 years of lead that you can do something about.
Yes. Let's see a little bit about what the title of your paper includes for the conference. And the title, as I could see, was Taming Corporate Power. And then my question will be, why should it be tamed and how?
So there is a very interesting division within the liberal movement between, if you want, a classical, mostly Northern American, but there are some Northern Americans that are not in this position, mostly Northern American view, that the only concern is the power of the government, because the government has the monopoly on the use of force. And the more European ordo-liberal tradition, but also a Chicago guy like Henry Simons, is in that part, that are very much afraid of private power. Mm-hmm. For two reasons. One is that you are concern about any concentration of power, because power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and Lord Acton said. But in addition to that, there is the risk that the high concentrated private power will get in cahoots with the government. And I think that it's not a coincidence that the people who are first to warn us about this are the German Ordo Liberal, because they saw this coming with the Nazi regime. The private power in Germany were very happy to compromise with the Nazi regime and form an happy family that led Europe to a disaster. But by the way, very similar was in Japan, in the nationalist Japan, the concentrated powers, the zaibatsu, were easily co-opted by the regime. So to me, every time power is concentrated, it naturally leads to some problem. So you do need to have fragmented power. And these days, corporations, especially in the United States, but throughout the world, are becoming some gigantic behemoth that cannot be regulated by the national state. And they're more powerful than most states. We always look at the past when United Fruit was running Guatemala, etc. But, you know, I think it's a little bit more subtle today. But try to be in a developing country and try to oppose Google or Facebook, and you tell me what happened to you.
Probably not something good. And it should be tamed then, because you want power to be distributed.
It should be tamed because I think this is deleterious both from an economic point of view and from a democratic point of view. I think that my major concern is actually on democracy rather than on the economy. There is evidence suggesting that Google can easily influence election. Everybody is up in arms against Facebook. I think Google is no less dangerous. And in fact, you may argue even more. And simply the way your searches are returned, so whether the bad news about you, I'm sure you have no bad news about you, but the bad news about a candidate versus the good news about a candidate, they are simply ordered in a different way. There are experiments showing that the order impacts the way people vote. Mm. So if I choose to have the first search on Biden comes Hunter Biden and the laptop versus Bo Biden and the hero that he was, is the other child of the president, and the hero that he was in the war, makes all the difference in my view of Joe Biden and the way people vote. And I am pretty confident that Google knows better than trying to interfere with the U.S. presidential election. But when you go to a lot of middle-sized country, who is watching? And is so tempted for some autocrats to say, you know, Google, do you want to play in this country? You have to play by my rules. And that's where being cahoots come about. Because I'm not thinking that Google is necessarily evil. In fact, they were claiming they do not evil. I'm simply saying there is a temptation. Where is the temptation, there is the risk. And one of the things I learned from Francis Fukuyama is this analogy that I love of the loaded gun. If you have a loaded gun on the table, the risk that that gun at some point will be pointed at you is pretty serious. And so you cannot think about a world in which there is a loaded gun and you are the only one holding the gun. If there is a loaded gun, sooner or later, the gun would be aimed at you. Yeah. Okay? And so I use the same principle and I say, I think that Google is a loaded gun. And if it's not aimed at you now...
It can be.
Exactly.
What about if we go back in history, because capitalism and market economy, I think about very easily the thinker, the Scottish thinker, Adam Smith, and the Enlightenment thinkers around him. And that was the start of the market economy and of capitalism and of many things. And I must add that Adam Smith also wrote other things than just Wealth of Nations,
of course,
which are important. But are there still things to learn about the market economy from him and from the thinkers around him? And are there insights that we have lost, you think?
Certainly, we lost a lot of insights. I think that there's clearly a fracture in the history of economic thought, starting with, I think, Alfred Marshall, when political economy becomes economics. And all the treaties before Marshall, the treaties of political economy, and then with Marshall, is just economics. And this is neoclassical economics that tries to ignore the issue of power. And I think that the classicals did not. And I think that that's a very important insight that needs to be brought back to the picture.
I'll tell you something afterwards then, and the listeners, they will just have to believe me that I think that I know what Luigi is talking about. They might look me up on Civitas page to see why. Anyway, we'll continue. How do you think capitalism could be developed to function better? I think about main institutional frameworks. I think about what the European Union can do, what countries can do. And I also know that you are in a panel with Thomas Philippon, if I'm not... yes, that's right. And he is also famous here in Norway by saying that he is French, you're Italian. He is also in the United States, but in New York. And he has said that... the competition seems to work better in the European Union and not in the United States, which might be a surprise to people to know that. But then again, what do you think could be done, and what do you think about the efforts being done?
Wow. How many hours do you have? the problem is huge. Let's try to break it down, because I think otherwise it would be impossible to answer. I think there is a very interesting... challenge by how you adapt the institution of capitalism to the digital economy. Because we are used to think about in terms of resources that are scarce. But when you go to information or even data, once you have collect them, sharing them is free. And so they're not intrinsically scarce. And today, we are treating them as we treat scarce good, as we treat a piece of equipment that in economic terms is a rivalrous good. And it says, if I use a car, you cannot use the car at the same time. But if I use some data to predict the future, but you can use the same data and your use does not detract from my use. Okay, so that's what is called non-rivalrous good. And I think that all basically economics is based on rivalrous good. And I think that how to think about this new sector is an open field that needs to be addressed. And how we rethink the concept of ownership in this context, for example, because again, we have a very good sense of ownership of a piece of land. We translated this into intellectual property, and I think we have gone a bit too far in that translation. I think that the intellectual property is too strict a boundary. And when you think about data property, I think we need to break new grounds as well. So I think that that's something that needs to be rethought in a serious way. And then, of course, there is the international dimension, which is not just economic, but is political. But the two are intrinsically related If you have a world in which you have free trade, but not a common policy, you are choosing to have a particular type of policy. We have a welfare in one country, but not in the others. And then the extreme, speaking of power multinational, the extreme is when we see that we had proposed treaties like the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, where you have multinationals being able to sue countries for regulation that was infringing their rights and being judged by arbitration, not by some normal courts. So So this is really even creating a different and a separate level of legislation. So I think it's very dangerous. And I think we need to think hard. I think that I find current times both very challenging, but also very exciting because we need to rethink a lot of the blocks. We are still basically debating 19th century theories, and we live in the 21st century.
Then maybe my last question about capitalism is the answer. He might have found it, I'm not sure, because you recently had an episode about the book The World After Capital, or After Capitalism, but it's After Capital by Albert Wenger. And what is his argument, and how do you see a world if it's after capital or after capitalism? But should we get rid of it, or what is his argument and your thoughts about it?
I find that book very interesting and at the same time a bit frustrating, because I think he has very good idea, but they are slightly off, in my view, and this is my personal view, the target. Because he has this this view that physical capital is abundant, which I don't think it is. We still need to raise a lot of money to, for example, provide infrastructure to the half of the world that does not have infrastructure. So, and is only abundant to the extent your needs are limited. So if you define your needs as very limited, then maybe we need less capital. However, as I said earlier, I think that data are abundant, and the question is, how do you share them? So I think that that's the first point. The second, he claims that there's not a proper market for attention. And again, I think there is some very deep insights here and some things that are a little bit off the mark. So one is, it is true that the market itself is not particularly good at capturing very distant or very low probability event. I had a student a couple of years ago who did a dissertation, unfortunately a year too early, about the risk of nuclear war. And of course, he was talking about the Cold War, not about the incoming Third World. But he found that the market was pretty good at capturing the cross-sectional risk. So to my surprise, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, if you had a company with a headquarter in a city that was on the primary target list of the Soviets, your stock price was dropping more than if you were located in a place where there was not the primary target, okay? However, that difference was really teeny tiny, okay? So you can claim victory because you get cross-section, but the level is off. In a sense, we now know that we got awfully close to a nuclear war. And even back then, I think the probability of a nuclear war was in the order of 20, 30, 40%, okay? It was not like a teeny tiny tail event. Now, if I go by memory, but the market when the Cuban Missile Crisis was announced dropped 3%. Mm-hmm. So that's nothing by comparison. And so I think that that's my inspiration to say the market is not very good at predicting this long-term stack. So we need some other form to allocate capital. And I think that Albert is right in that. And number two, and this is even more problematic, I think that the private sector has become incredibly good at manipulating the preferences. I remember that one of the first reading I did in middle school was a reading about advertising manipulating the taste of Americans. And and I dismissed it. I think it was excessive, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. And I think that traditional advertising was creating a little bit of a distortion, but I don't think it was as bad as we are today. So today, we know, the company know about you more than you know about yourself. And they know about your weaknesses more than they know about yourself. You know about your weaknesses. They know when you... they can pray about their weakness. In a sense, we are an epsilon away from the moment where they know when your blood sugar is low. and you don't reason as well as sort of you should to take advantage of you and give you what they want. I think that that's a pretty scary moment.
Mm. And that's, of course, connected to the use of technology and data, of course.
Of course, of course. And I'm not a Luddite. I don't think that we should not use those data. but I think that we should be careful. And this is where I disagree with most of my American colleagues, because they think, oh, as long as the data are in private hand, I don't fear them. And I said, absolutely not, because in my view, when you have a private monopoly of data, you have the worst of both worlds, because on the one hand, if the government wants that data, it's going to get that data. And it says, if Trump wanted to know from Google what I was doing, he gets a way to get the data from Google. And no protection against predation is in place in private hands. So I think we have the worst of both worlds.
So that's where the European came back then, the European or the Italian in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining me today, Luigi. And you can get a couple of minutes or your minutes to just say what your plans for your podcast, what they are, and people should listen to that if they want to have, I would say, a nuanced picture of capitalism. But go, what are your plans?
My plans is actually to be in exploration mode. As I said, I think we are in a fantastic moment of transition. And if people claim they know the truth, they're probably wrong, because historically this has always been the case, but particularly now. And so I don't make that claim at all. And I think that what I think is unique of the podcast that Bethany and I run these days is that we try to challenge both sides. There is a ample variety, in a sense. We have from Francis Fukuyama or Glenn Hubbard to Piketty or Varoufakis. We treat everybody with respect, and we criticize everybody. I think in that sense, when you say what is the essence of Chicago, that's the essence of Chicago.
Very good then. Thank you very much, Luigi. And if you like Liberal Haltime, you can rate us and recommend us or give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or my colleague eirik@civita.no. Information about Civita is available on our homepage. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal Haltime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.